And now,
from the didgeridoo to 140 miles east of Kalamazoo, at least as far as Google Maps says, this version is a tribute to Motown.
Chill Pack Hollywood Hour with Dean Haglund and Phil Lernis.
Oh, if you were listening to us before we started recording, you would know that Dean Haglund's laughing at my predicament of having no eyesight.
Hilarious. You have eyesight. It's just damaged.
It's just really bad. It's just really, really bad. We were comparing notes on what it was like. Well, not comparing notes. You were asking what it was like to travel with very little eyesight and coming back with even less eyesight than before. But this is your Chill Pack Hollywood Hour. I am Phil Lernis, back in Los Angeles, and having just returned to Detroit Motor City. It's the Motor City Madman, Dean Haglund. How are you, Dean?
Detroit. I didn't know that's what we called this.
Well, it's French.
I like Detroit.
Detroit.
It is French.
Yeah.
Detroit.
Yeah. Of three, I guess, is what it means, right? Of three.
Yes. No. The three. yes. This is what it's known as, the three.
And Dean was saying that he's really exhausted because he was at X-Fest, a big X-Files convention, and a lot of partying, and he compared it to a high school reunion. Now, was your high school reunion that much fun?
Well, I never went.
So you've got no comparison, really.
Well, I went to Patty's high school reunion.
Oh, how was that catching up with her old friends?
It was good. I thought they were great. So
you're saying that X-Fest was like Patty's high school reunion?
Well, no, now that I think about it, I've never been to any high school reunion where I knew anybody. So
exactly. This
is my only experience of reuniting with old friends that I haven't seen. Some, dare I say, like Chris Owens, I'm going to say 15 years since we've seen each other.
Right.
Agent Spencer.
Right, because although you both appeared in these seasons, these revival seasons of The X-Files, you certainly didn't appear together or even in the same shows. So your paths would not cross. And that's I've always heard that he is a very, very nice gentleman. That's what I've heard.
Oh, so nice. So generous. Still bursting with energy. Loves to laugh. The whole nine yards. So it was great. And surprisingly, now he's a mere 3 hours away from me in the big city of Toronto, Canada. So I guess technically 4 hours away from me. So we have plans to meet up in the upcoming year.
On Mackinac Island.
Mackinac Island.
Somewhere in time. You're gonna go in period fashion. My brother-in-law, Ben Brown's parents will probably be there because that's their favorite spot anywhere. They'll chaperone you. It'll be great, great fun. Before we get too into the weeds about X-Files conventions and
X-Fest
and my trip to the nation's capital, I was struck by something that occurred, near the top of last week, since we've recorded, though, which was the 75th anniversary of D-Day, of the invasion in Normandy, because so often of late, apropos of our usual celebrity deaths, and celebrity deaths will not be heard this week, so that we might bring you a very special show, but We've been talking about how, you know, the calendar's turning as they do. We're losing all those heroes from that era, and we're losing the people that reported on their activities, the chroniclers of that era. And so I was really struck, Dean, about the fact that they had the 75th, because ordinarily, historically, they only do a celebration on the 10 years. So the last big celebration there was the 60th. And before that on the 50th, but they realized, the 60th, the last one was the 70th then, but they realized they needed to do a 5-year, a 75th, because they realized that this is probably the last time that any men who participated in the invasion of Normandy, the landing at Normandy, would actually be able to attend the ceremonies there. And it was powerful, and they had so many women, so many, we'll call them the Rosies, right? The Rosie the Riveters. We know that the actual inspiration for Rosie the Riveter died this past year. We talked about her, but so many of her ilk, these women that went into the assembly line.
Workforce.
Yeah, workforce. Women who built the planes that ended the war. Right.
Absolutely. And actually did test flying, too. A lot of those bombers had to be delivered to England, and it was often women who flew them across the ocean and then returned. And as each new product came out of your Lockheed and your Grumman, it was women who tested the maneuverability and the aerodynamics of a lot of these things.
You're sure you're not getting this confused with the plot of Captain Marvel? All right, which we'll talk about next week on next week's show. But I was really struck because this was the first time that many of them attended the ceremony there in Normandy, and so to see many of them reunited with their husbands, their brothers, for the first time, because of course they're brothers and husbands and. Men that they knew, young boys really that they knew, were laid to rest there, having died that day, and so it was incredibly emotional images that I was seeing that day, and I attended a high school baccalaureate that night, as one does when they're in the nation's capital. I love a good baccalaureate. You always, you know, but I do like a baccalaureate. I attended the baccalaureate and the graduation and after parties for my eldest nephew, Vernon the Fourth, a very fine young man, and Spirit
is he at the wedding?
Spirit Award winner. Of course, he was one of my junior groomsmen. And
okay.
And anyway, he graduated from Landon, and I was struck that night, the night of the 75th anniversary of D-Day, to be sitting behind all these young men at the baccalaureate and realizing, boy, if this was 75 years earlier, these boys would all be shipping out if they had not already, because they were that age, and it's. I don't know what the word is, but it was a profoundly emotional realization. The idea that these boys would
young.
Be going and being forced to fight wars that men my age were responsible for.
Right. Yeah. Way to go, Phil.
Yeah. Well, men your age too, Dean. So I'm not going to hit you with questions about genocide either this week, because we want to keep in the celebratory mood. But we'll table that discussion for next week. But you will get a kick out of this, and this is another reason I wanted to bring up the 75th, and it dovetails into our journeys. But one of the things when bringing that up, the 75th anniversary and how moving it was, and to realize we're losing all these heroes. Someone said to me, well, not only that, I read an article that Civil War reenactments are really in jeopardy because they're losing all the reenactors. The reenactors are at the age where they're that's really, I mean,
that's tough. So there's not a new generation of reenactors coming up.
I mean, we're losing the hero, those heroes that reenacted the sacrifices made by a generation earlier. That would be like you and I on this show being so moved about, oh my God, not only are we losing these heroes that participated in World War II, but we're losing all the actors who played World War II heroes on screen.
I know. Right? Oh, my God. And the players of Call of Duty. They're down in numbers.
What will we do when we lose those firsthand reenactors?
That's hilarious.
Yeah, I knew you would get a kick out of that.
I'm sure somebody else wants to reenact Civil War somewhere in the future.
But many people... back east asked about Mr. Dean Haglund. Many people who were participants or in attendance at really what has gone down as hashtag best wedding ever. You know, just to be nominated, I feel like we were winners.
Yeah, really. But congratulations.
But as you know, it was a big, big, big movable feast, a wedding in 10 or 12 parts over a long weekend. And that was something unlike what many people had ever experienced before. And yes, many people asked about your move, your settling in back in the States. What changed that that the banishment ended, you know, that Trump allowed you to return? And
that's right.
So
I got through the wall.
I filled them in as best I could. But of course, I'm dying to hear about your trip to Schaumburg, Illinois. You flew to Chicago from Detroit.
Yes, 1 hour, 17 minutes of pure unadulterated joy aboard United States.
And you you spent no time in the Windy City.
No time at all. No, in fact, I went the other way from O'Hare, away from the Windy City,
and
directly to the Hyatt Regency.
We have lists.
I got there.
We have listeners, Dean, who would be very disappointed that I actually got the moniker of the town correct, because, of course, I've become somewhat known for mixing up the monikers of cities. I mean, I should have said, you spent no time in Beantown.
the Windy City of Beans. Oh, yeah.
They picked you up, the X-Fest folks picked you up at the airport and whisked you to Schaumburg? Is that what happened?
Yeah, well, in fact, there was a lovely limo service. With Limo Jim.
Oh my
goodness. He's born and raised, had his limo company for 31 years, loves the town so much. And actually, I took his phone number because I think I'm going to plan a little trip to Chicago and have Limo Jim show me the neighborhoods and the things that the tourists don't get to see. Because I've been to Chicago, 10, 15 times. But generally, it's the... You know, we hit the same art galleries, the Navy Pier, you know, Second City, Zanies. Like, you do sort of the same sort of things each time we're there. And so we thought, wouldn't it be great to just hire Limo Jim to drive us around to, like, amazing, authentic pizza and Italian restaurants and neighborhoods far, far away from the loop?
One of the places that I'm dying to go, and of course I was going to go, the plan was for Lily and I to connect with you there and spend some time at the convention, but my eyesight precluded it. But one of the reasons that I also wanted to go was it would give a good opportunity to spend time on either side with my friends, the Terenzios, Maurice Terenzio and his lovely wife, Diane. We've heard from Maurice on this show many, many times. They were in attendance at the hashtag best wedding ever. And but there is a very authentic Italian deli in that family that I'm dying. And, you know, I'm not Mr. Big into eating the meats anymore, and I'm dying to go there. So
that's fantastic.
Yeah.
But the X-Fest itself was very well organized. Very impressed at how well it went. It was a whirlwind. Of course, Lone Gunman there only the one day. That was Saturday. And then so we fly in Friday, sign all day Saturday, and fly out Sunday morning.
But and, you did other things other than just sign. There was some kind of live audio commentary you and the other gunmen were doing, wasn't
there? Well, here's where we were mistaken. It turns out we go up and we're in a tent. We're in the wedding tent outside the hotel where there's a big screen and everybody's there. And Unusual Suspects, the Lone Gunman episode that has introduces our backstory, as it were, is going to play. And there's a podium in front of the screen on the stage. And so I go, okay, great. So the three of us go up there and we'll just talk right through it. And they go, no, just introduce it. We'll watch it. And then there'll be a Q&A afterwards. I'm like, what? No. We were going to just hack on each other and like Mystery Science Theater 3000. We were just going to make fun of each other. And he said, no. We'll just have a Q&A after. So we're like, we were really disappointed, actually. But it was great to watch it again and see it. I have not seen it since 1997, I guess. So
And of course, one of the delights of it, Richard Belzer, right?
Absolutely. How cool is that? He had playing Detective Munch, the only actor in history to play his character on four different series, same character. So X-Files, Picket Fences, Homicide, and the fourth one, I forget.
Well, one of the Law and Orders, I'm imagining,
oh, yeah,
right?
Law and Order, yeah. That's right.
Right, because I don't know if we're allowed to tell this, but I was at your house one time. This is many, many, many years ago. Do you remember this? And was Kyle Secor? It must have been,
yes.
Kyle Secor. Yeah. And
yeah.
And Belzer calls Kyle Secor, who, you know, they had starred together on Homicide, right? Was it Homicide?
Yeah.
And Belzer, do you remember this? Belzer calls Kyle Secor and is complaining about a certain co-star. This is early in whatever Law and Order this was, and I'm guessing it's SVU, but I get them a little bit confused now, even though I've seen them, but the titles and everything. So forgive me, you Law and Order fan, LNO heads, if I get this wrong. But I think it's Special Victims Unit, and it was kind of early in its run. And Richard Belzer calls to air some grievances, to some frustration, let's say, about how slow the filming process is going because they've cast as his partner, as a co-star, not an actor. They've cast Ice-T, someone known for other creative outlets rather than acting. And Dean, I mean, in fairness, we don't want to make Belzer seem like an asshole. It just, those can be really long days. And depending on where you're filming, you know, really long days and sweltering heat. And it can be frustrating when you're there for no fault of your own that things keep going on. And so he needed to get it off his chest. He calls his old buddy Kyle Secor. He complains about, you know, and he doesn't complain about the other actor so much as he complains about the producers. And he says, you know, what are they thinking casting somebody who hasn't acted before? He's a nice guy, but, you know, cast an actor, for crying out loud. Otherwise, we're all paying the price. And you both listen to this. And then Secor says, well, Richard, now you know how we all felt.
I don't remember that story at all, actually.
Yeah.
That's right. I guess because Richard was a comedian.
He was a comedian when he first came to Homicide. Yeah.
That's right. Isn't that fascinating?
And he received that very well, by the way. I do want to button that with that story that said that it really snapped Belzer back into, you know, reality.
The perspective.
The perspective,
right?
Absolutely. Well, we all have to start somewhere. I mean, that's the thing.
Yeah, right? And now look at both Ice-T and Belzer. They're fantastic actors, actually.
Yeah,
really,
of course. Of course, they're really, really interesting. But, you know, first time on the set of a television series and
It can be disorienting and you don't know what a mark is or any of the terminology and all that sort of thing.
and you're expected to already know it. And so anyway, okay, so you don't do the Mystery Science Theater running commentary of the episode, but you do a Q&A afterwards. Did you do any improv at this, Dean?
No, and I was people, the fans requested. Some of them remember seeing me as far back as Chicago, 1998. If you can imagine, some went to the expo, the X-Files expo, and I guess it was that one was 98. Yeah, that at the Navy Pier. But some others even saw the earlier shows. It would have been 96-ish that I was in Chicago with Creations. And so it was a lot of people who had seen my improv show, hoping I was doing it again. And the organizers said, we'll get you on the next one. So, because, you know, they didn't know, I think, that I did the stand-up, as far as I could tell.
What?
I know. You perform for 20 years, doing the stages around the world, Edinburgh Fringe Festival, Melbourne Comedy Festival, every festival and comedy thing you can do. And if it's not on YouTube, it doesn't exist. Yeah. That's all. Because, you know, improv on filming improv is always so much less funny than actually seeing improv.
Many of our listeners were able to see you, were able to, in some cases, meet you for the first time. Some of our most loyal listeners. One of the big takeaways, very excited, apparently you vouched for the fact that the graphic novel would be concluded before Christmas.
I am now boots to the ground, committed to this thing. I am going to get less sleep in order to complete this thing. I am now taking the drawing pen to bed with me. It's the last thing I do before I fall asleep, the first thing I do when I wake up.
Now, as an out, though, you just might want to keep in mind, as far as I can tell from the transcripts of the event, did you ever say Christmas of what year?
Yeah, I did not. Hey, good one. Thank you. there we go.
How were Tom and Bruce?
Oh, excellent as always. They're really good. Tom, of course, has his cabin up in the woods, fishes right off the porch. Bruce, as always, doing theater. They're looking swell. In fact, I'm looking at the group photo that we did of all of us. And we haven't changed a bit, of all things.
It's always fun when you get to see them, right? I mean, it's so it was just a little more than 2 years ago, I think, when you last saw them at Monster Con in Dallas, Texas.
Dallas, right? That was before Hartford, Connecticut, for sure, right? Yeah. I get them all mixed up now.
Oh, well, no, I thought Hartford was before that.
Yeah, right?
It was at Hartford where, right around then, that the news broke.
That we were in season 10.
Exactly. So I thought, well, I don't know. Who knows? Who cares? But anyway, the point is, it's always fun to see them. And did we learn anything, Dean, at the convention about the future of the X-Files in any form? Did we learn about anything?
No news was broken about the future of the X-Files in relationship to Fox, but I did announce my Patreon that's coming up in the next couple weeks, where the long story short, I had a fan made some lovely Lone Gunman Lego figures, one-offs, that he gave to me, that I'm now going to do a fun stop motion animation Lone Gunman adventure. And I actually went on the final party. I took Tom and Bruce into the quiet part of the bathroom and had them record some lines for the stop motion animation, which made everybody quite alarmed at what we were doing, particularly those who came in to actually use the bathroom. And so this, I'm going to start filming and editing. There'll be a monthly 5-minute episode of a Lone Gunman stop motion action adventure. So that's X-File news right there. So it'll be available exclusively as a level on my Patreon.
Lone Gunman will continue in the Lone Gunman rule, and they will continue to reign in Lego form. You've heard it here. Wow. Now, who else did you run into? Did you?
Yeah, the whole gang. Agent Krycek was there. Nick Lee. He's just had twins, doing very well. His wife just won a British Columbia Acting Award, known as the Leo, for Best Actress in Bletchley Park. We also ran into Frank Spotnitz, now living in Paris, working on, of all things, I'm super excited about. We talked almost an hour about the new Leonardo da Vinci miniseries, a co-production with France, Germany, Italy, and England. So he's writing that. It's all together. They start casting. And I laid out my knowledge of what I knew. And he at times said, I did not know that about Da Vinci. So there you go. I have a school in Frank on a guy who's doing a miniseries about Leonardo da Vinci. So
there's some. So the involvement that Haglund will have in that series is what exactly?
The conversation we had at the bar. This is as far as I know. Thus far, that's my involvement.
Oh, all
but
right.
You never know. There could
I don't
be...
know. I don't know why you're being cagey about it.
I didn't. You know, I'm not that guy that goes, "Hey, is there a part for me in that thing you're doing?" I never say that out loud at any time. I'm always happy to work on anybody's project, but for some reason, I never explicitly go, hey, I would love to be in that project.
I would have thought you would have wanted to say, hey, I would love to be a technical advisor on that project.
Well, even that never comes to mind while I'm chatting.
Yeah. So I would love to give walking tours of Da Vinci sites. Anyway, did you get to the bottom of what the hell happened with him and Man in the High Castle for me?
I did not. No, I didn't bring it up. I thought it was a bone of contention, perhaps. And this was we were talking happy times. We were looking forward and not dwelling on the past. So I skipped Man in the High Castle. He's been working on a Medici series that I've watched a couple episodes. I think I binged the first season already that I quite enjoyed. So, and the quality of that production, if that's any similar to the quality of the Da Vinci miniseries coming up, it's going to be spectacular.
All right. We're going to go to a little bit of an interview in a minute, but any last takeaways from the weekend that you want to share?
Well, it was great to see old friends, many people who listen to our podcast religiously. We say thank you. Someone mentioned that they work out listening to us. So continue that. Burn. Do the burn.
Feel the burn. Feel the burn.
Yeah, exactly. And and put a face to some names, including the venerable Agent Summer.
Oh, venerable.
Showed up.
Venerable. Okay, that's an interesting word choice for Agent Summer. Yeah, I'm so glad that you got to meet Agent Summer. That's very cool.
Yeah, it was really cool. Fans from everywhere around the world. They all flew in. England, Germany represented, of course, Manu was there. A huge Mexican contingent, Experiente X Secreto.
Sure. Yeah. I've seen Spain the existence of that. Yeah.
Yeah. So that was really cool. They were there. And it was really actually a lovely time.
Good.
One of my favorite cons that I've been to in a very, very long time.
Excellent. Next up for you, I guess, is August in Knoxville, Tennessee, right? A paranormal convention. And we'll preview that as that approaches. For now, we're going to leave you with part one of an interview I did with our old friend, especially good friend of Dean Haglund, Chase Masterson. Dean interviewed Chase in the movie The Truth Is Out There, and have a wonderful conversation. Her contribution is really to that movie is indelible. It adds such an important, really kind of emotional tone to the piece. But because I think of that, because of that interview, I think we kind of overlooked the fact that we'd never had her on the show to talk about acting and to talk about music and to talk about her social activism.
The anti-bullying thing she does.
She runs an anti-bullying coalition, but I mean, she is really, like so many of our favorite people, a Renaissance person and a genuine delight. And so here's part one of our conversation with her, and we'll catch you on your Chill Pack Hollywood Hour next week. Thanks, Dean.
Thank you.
You might know our guest from her longtime role on Star Trek Deep Space Nine. You might know her from her singing, from other acting roles, from her charity work, which is extraordinary, from her appearance in our documentary, The Truth Is Out There. Who knows? You might not even know her at all, but I'm sure you're going to enjoy my conversation with her. She's spectacular. Her name is Chase Masterson. And here she is. I am sitting here with Chase Masterson. Chase, welcome to the podcast, actually for the first time.
I can't believe it's been so long that we've known each other and we have never sat down like this. It's really wonderful.
Dean Hagland was fortunate enough to get to interview you in our film,
yes.
The Truth Is Out There.
Yes.
And,
hi, Dean.
And you
hi, Patty.
Actually lurked in the background while we interviewed Sam Stone on the podcast one time.
Yes, I did.
But this is the first time that I've been able to welcome you as a guest.
Yes.
So we have so much to talk about.
Yes.
And so I'm going to start in the most esoteric place imaginable, which is something I've been thinking about the last few days. I heard a phrase that the Achilles heel of consciousness is that we forget. And so what has been occurring to me is that the purpose then of stories and storytellers is to inspire people to remember.
Right. Yeah, that's beautiful.
So what do you find that you hope you can inspire people to remember?
Oh, gosh, what a great question. Powerful question. I think that there's so much truth to what you said in terms of people forgetting. I think that each of us knows deep down incredible truths that we don't take with us in our day-to-day lives. And those are truths that speak of, you know, that cause us to act in empathy and in compassion and in just a general awareness of how others want and need to be treated and deserve to be treated. And in our forgetting, we become less than the people that we could be. And I think that's what inspires us so much about entertainment, TVs, movies, books, comics, anything, is that we remember in these stories, which are transcendent. They remind us of our true selves, our capabilities. I believe that most people are really good inside. And I mean, sorry if that's cliche, but I believe that we all have a desire and tendency to be good. And yet that's replaced temporarily by what we want in the moment. Like, I think it's Goethe said that all unhappiness is derived from doing what we want in the moment as opposed to what we want in the long term.
Wow, you just brought Goethe You played the Goethe card that early in the conversation. I mean, for those of you listening at home playing the Goethe drinking game, you yeah. must now take a shot.
Down it, babe. I mean, that's it. I think
wow.
that might be, right?
Okay, so one of the things that's really interesting, right, is that we all have this desire for cleanly delineated heroes and villains, right? I mean, we like that. We enjoy that.
Yeah.
There is something, and yet...
Universally, right?
Universally.
I mean, really, the human condition.
And yet, so we love, look, there's nothing better than, you know, a villain we love to hate. But it becomes really powerful if there's a villain that you hate to hate, that you wish you didn't have to hate, but that circumstances have made them a villain. Mm.
Right.
And
like ourselves sometimes.
So, and this is what happens when we start to learn, so much is made of a hero's backstory, but when we learn more about a villain's backstory,
yes.
because every human being on this planet that you will meet has a story that can break your heart.
Yes.
If you're open and available to the telling of that story.
Yes.
So, suddenly that our perception as the audience changes so dramatically when we get to share the villain's story.
It's so true. So true. And who are we to stand in judgment of someone else's, of who someone else is? Certainly, we can not like things they've done, but when we don't know a person's backstory, it doesn't mean we excuse
right.
bad things.
No, there's no excuse for bad behavior.
No excuse. Mm-hmm. Very clear about that. But when you understand where a person has come from and what has led to bad behavior, it certainly can bring an empathy for the entire story. Father G at Homeboy, where I know
Homeboy. Yeah.
Yeah.
Okay.
So I volunteered with Homeboy very closely since 2008, and I used to teach a class there and mentored hundreds of kids there very, very closely. And Father G, the founder, says, you can't hate someone you know. And then also, there is no them. There's only us. And once we put aside those barriers and see the commonalities and give empathy for people who have had to carry so much, it becomes a different world.
Well, and this is something that I don't think gets discussed enough, right? We can all agree that there's no excuse for bad behavior, that bad behavior should be dealt with appropriately.
Right.
There's the larger conversation, though, of how do we heal the ramifications of that bad behavior? And that always has to come back to a healing energy, compassion and love.
Yeah.
Otherwise, in some way, so I define, and having gone through violence prevention training, I define violence as any act, energy, or force that can injure, harm, or destroy.
Right.
It's not just physical. It can be emotional. It can be words.
Psychological. Yeah, sure.
And it also takes away the personal, that definition. Can nature be violent? Of course nature can be violent. It's a part of nature. This is why
yeah.
we hear
yeah.
a violent storm
right.
has led to this.
Right.
And I also believe that most violent behavior that humans perpetrate is learned behavior, most of it. So therefore, if we want to heal not just perhaps the person or people on the receiving end, but society at large after an act of violence or destruction, we really have to make sure that violence is not what survives.
Mm, so well said. Yes. Yes.
And that's what worries me so increasingly about things like action film. Where violence is the response
so
to violence.
So true, right? I mean, you know, people freak out about skin showing on screen and or in life, you know, and yet you can kill thousands of people in one shot in an action sequence and nobody says a thing.
I actually have this idea where I want to make a film someday that has a spectacular action sequence. And instead of it being a climax of the film, it's actually the midpoint. So the threat, whatever that is solved through this climactic action and violence sequence at the middle.
Right.
And then the second half from there is, how do we pick up the pieces?
It's about the healing.
How do we account for all the collateral damage to that supposedly necessary act we did to solve a threat?
So well said, yeah. And something that intrigues me also is, and this is really what it lights a fire under me, how do we create a society where we prevent violence in every way, emotional, psychological, and certainly physical and sexual? How do we teach people or lead people better early on in their lives to where we create a climate of such empathy and compassion that something like that would be unthinkable? How do we really see each other for who we are and never have that even come up?
Well, you're talking about needing to instill in people a sense of their own self-worth and self-empowerment.
Yes, it all comes back to healthy identity, which sounds kind of
cheesy,
but it really is. Healthy people don't hurt each other.
You know, for us, the answer in part is through better stories, right?
Yeah.
I mean, you know, I saw this neighborhood's representative is in Congress, is Adam Schiff, the head of the House, who was just asked to step down
from the committee,
the chair of the committee,
The
Intelligence Committee. But I saw him speak last week at our town hall, and he said something that was really moving, which is that, you know, it can be so overwhelming in times of darkness, all the things that need to get done, and it can paralyze us.
Yeah.
So it's not your job to even have to figure out how you solve all of it.
No.
Your job is to do the thing you can do.
Yes.
And do it as well as you possibly can.
Yes.
And then when you find you can take on more, do it.
Yeah.
Right?
Yeah. Just the next right thing.
Exactly.
Because it can seem so overwhelming, like, well, if I do this, then I'm going to have to do that, and I don't know how to do that. But no, you don't have to know how to do the second thing. You do the first thing, maybe you'll meet someone who does, or maybe you'll, you know, the first thing is usually showing up. It's actually going to
meet
like-minded people.
This is tough as a storyteller, an artist, and an entertainer, right? There's always that voice in us of, well, will this find an audience? Will it, you know? And I had a teacher once tell me, you know, if your work only changes one person, it's worth it, provided that one person is yourself.
Mm.
And that's where that just take that first step comes in. Because if you're really giving your all to it and finding out what you're made of in the process, mm-hmm. you are, I think, building a better you.
Yeah.
And you're giving other people permission to do the same thing, which is no small thing.
Yeah.
You never will know, and this is the frustrating thing, because we like to know, we like to have this kind of reward, but we'll never know what crops spring up out of those kind of seeds that get planted.
Yeah, that impact, definitely.
But giving people permission to take better care of themselves, to tend to the things that matter to them,
right?
That ripples outwards.
Yeah, absolutely.
So this idea of remembering. What do you remember, Chase, about when you first knew that the arts, a life in the arts, was something that you wanted to pursue?
Oh, thank you for asking. I was five, and I was in a production of Oklahoma
What? You were in a real production of Oklahoma
yes.
at five?
Yes. Oh my God. I played Child, and wow. my mom was in the show, and I just remember the community, really, that theater was oh. bringing, and getting piggyback rides around the theater, and I just glimpses of memory of being backstage and it being fun and wonderful and having friends that were all working on the same thing at mm. the same time, wanting the same thing, and the smell of makeup and someone painting on my eyebrows and just little things like that that just all were, I don't know, that were new and fresh and exciting for me. And actually before that, my mother was a theater director and an actress in the theater for a very long time. And I remember this, one of my first memories, had me in the living room of our house in Indiana. And she said, "Do you know how mommy goes and does these things at night and goes to rehearsal and does plays? Would you like to do that too?" And I said, yes. And that was it.
Wow. Where in Indiana is this?
Indianapolis. Okay. Fort Benjamin Harrison, where my okay. father was stationed.
So it's at a dramatically different story, but it's at this age where, about five, where everyone around Lily realized that this was in the cards for her.
Oh, wow.
Not because she was in an actual production, and not because she would pretend to be in productions, but because she would always pretend to have to audition for productions. And the story goes that at one audition, you know, she's 5 years old, she's in her parents' bedroom, she is limbering up along the imaginary ballet bar, and she turned to the imaginary dancer next to her, and she asked out loud, "So how long have you been in the business?"
What?
And at that moment, everybody said, yeah, okay, the die is cast.
Here. That's fantastic. Wow. How did she know to, I mean, did she have other role models nearby, or was it?
I don't know. No one who is in.
So how long have you been in the business?
How great is it that.
Puffing on a cigar.
That's the part that drew her. It wasn't being in the spotlight and being someone else. It was living the life and getting to have a conversation with yeah. someone about the life that they're living.
Yeah, and doing the work.
That's what, you know, and when you described what you remembered, you were bringing in all of these visceral sense-related memories.
Hmm. About other right. people, about the community. Yeah. I don't actually even remember.
The smell of makeup, yeah. for example.
Yeah.
It wasn't this. It wasn't an idea at all. It wasn't the idea of, oh, I like this pretending to be other people. I like it, which is fun. There's no question about
yeah,
it.
Yeah, I don't remember being on stage. I remember this invitation into this wonderful life.
Into this community and yeah. into this life.
Yeah.
Wow.
And that's what it still is for me. Yeah.
So you are a Renaissance person, like all the most interesting people I know.
Right back to you.
Acting, singing, producing, teaching. So when does singing start? I mean, you're in Oklahoma, but that's a different thing. Singing in shows is a different thing.
Very different.
Than
yeah.
Finding that voice that can communicate just through song in a recording.
Yeah.
Because so much of it's not that musical theater performers aren't great singers, but they also have more resources at their disposal to convey the story and to convey the character.
Right.
And different responsibilities, too.
Right.
Namely, it isn't them singing, it is the character
yes.
singing.
Yes, yeah.
And yeah. I have known those people who can sing wonderfully in character, but absent the character, there isn't the unique voice. There isn't that of something that needs to be conveyed through song.
Sure, yeah.
So when do you discover that you have that drive to convey your own soul's experiences through song?
Thank you for asking. When I was also still very young, I did a production of The Fantastics at a theater called Moulin Rouge that my mother and my sister and I worked at a lot. And some of my earliest best memories are there. And I played Louisa, and that was a joy to me, just to be able to walk into that role of a young girl coming of age and realize that I could handle that. I was a young girl coming of age, and to be able to have the artistry to go along with my own journey, the own, you know, El Gallo taking Louisa away, and Let's Just Dance, that song, you know, and Soon It's Gonna Rain, and all of those beautiful experiences, it was magic to me. And then shortly after that, I choreographed a show at the same theater called Rodgers and Hart, a musical celebration. And I was 13 when I choreographed this full show of songs from the 40s.
Wow.
But I loved it so much, and I studied it, and I had help from this incredible director-choreographer named Larry Alderetti. Hi, Larry, who was and is such a lifelong mentor to me. I don't mean to go on about it,
no,
but it meant so much to be able to walk into that music at that young age and appreciate it, as I already had, because, you know, growing up in musical theater, Rodgers and Hammerstein, of course,
the Great American Songbook.
Great American Songbook. But this was even before Rodgers and Hammerstein. This was Rodgers and Hart, Larry Hart,
sure.
Who, anyway, so I felt like I was being let in on this incredible history and this incredible group of secrets, you know, and the rest of my friends were going to the mall and trying to become on Josky's teen board, and not even friends. They weren't friends. They were the other girls in school.
Peers.
They were
your peers.
Peer group, they were the same
age.
General age, but not, you know, not my friends. I wasn't in the group. I was very much outside the group and, you know, looked down on, bullied and all that. And I just knew the theater was somewhere where I could go and be safe. It's funny, isn't it?
Well, I have experienced that the outsider, and you're describing yourself as an outsider among your age peers and your school peers.
Yeah.
My experience has been that the outsider can ultimately be, can be the ultimate insider, because as the outsider, you're able to draw connections to things that when you're on the inside of something, you can't. And namely, you can draw connections between what is healthy about a community and what is unhealthy about a community. This is why originally we were talking about shamanism beforehand. And, you know, the earliest actors were the shaman. These were the people that would put on ritual magic to try to heal something going on in a community. And they would live apart from the community, on the outside, in the woods, and they would see what was going on, and they would go to their fellow shaman, and they would say, you know, this is what's plaguing the community. Let's put on this ritual about it. But really, it's a play. It's like, Chase, you're going to embody what is threatening the community.
Interesting,
and these people over here will play the heroic forces that are going to drive that out. And if we do this ritual well, we will create a catharsis within the community that will heal it in some way, right? So this is why I think the superstitions of theater continue to this day, because it finds its origins in magic.
Interesting. Wow, yeah.
I didn't mean to go off on that tangent.
No, it's okay. They're outsiders, though.
But you're outsiders.
And
it's a unique perspective.
Yeah.
But one of the things you get from that perspective is you really can, if you embrace it, value community in a way that you never could have if you were born on the inside.
Yeah. There's
so
an incredible power in a lot of the things that initially hurt us. And just the idea, just having resilience, and a lot of that comes from perspective, you know? A lot of it comes from having your values in a place where you can let something go because your heart is on the real prizes of life, which is not easy to do in this business with time and pressure, and there's so much that grabs our attention, you know, the need to make a living and all of that. it's so hard to keep perspective on what's really important. But if we can do that, then resilience is so much easier.
Guests of your Chill Pack Hollywood Hour stay at the Baldwin Hills Motor Inn. Promotional consideration paid for by Empire State Gas. From farm to pump, we've got great gas. Belated spoiler alert.